Welcome, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and you're at the Right Now Mastermind class for April 2012. Our guest today is Sue Williams Silverman. Her memoir, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, is also a Lifetime television movie. Her first memoir, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, won the AWP Award in Creative Nonfiction, while her craft book, Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir, was awarded Honorable Mention in Forward Review's Book of the Year Award in the category of writing. As a professional speaker, Sue has appeared on The View, Anderson Cooper 360, and CNN Headline News. She teaches in the MFA in Writing program at Vermont College of Fine Arts. You can visit her website at suewilliamssilverman.com. And as I said, I'm recording this call. I'll be sending you the link later this week, along with a link to Sue's website and her wonderful list of memoir books. Welcome, Sue.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad to have discovered you and your wonderful books.
Oh, thank you.
Sue, I just want to start by hearing how you got started memoir writing. I know that you talked in your Fearless Confessions about starting out as a fiction writer. So how did you make that transition?
I did, actually. I did start out writing fiction, and ironically, in many ways, I was trying to tell my story about growing up in an incestuous family and even sort of about sex addiction, but I was trying to do it by writing novels. And that really just was not working. The novels were terrible. I'm really glad that none of them were published because I would be embarrassed if they had been published. So I really was struggling to find sort of that authentic voice in fiction. And ironically, it was really at the urging of my therapist who kind of was after me. He kept saying to me, Sue, you know, why don't you tell your story as nonfiction? And that went on really for a few years. He kept telling me to write my story straight, you know, just as nonfiction. I would keep saying, no, 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 I'm a fiction writer. And of course, what he knew and knew more than I knew about me was that I was really scared to write it as nonfiction. But finally, my parents died, and at that point he said, Sue, maybe now you'll feel safe enough to write your story as nonfiction. But I still didn't think that I could do it as nonfiction. I mean, I don't think I'd ever even read a memoir at that point. And so sort of to humor him, I said, okay, you know, I'll write it like a little short paragraph or something like that, maybe a page. And I started out, I sort of turned on my computer and I started out, and within about 3 months, my first memoir, the one that you mentioned, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, I mean, that just absolutely fell out of me in 3 months. So clearly, my therapist was right. I was ready to write a memoir, and I just didn't know it. And it was a huge relief, actually, to get that book out of me and to realize that I could tell my story without the guise of fiction. I mean, there's nothing wrong, of course, with writing fiction or poetry. I don't mean it that way. But just for me, writing fiction was not working. And so finally, I sort of found an emotionally authentic voice, which is my, you know, voice of memoir or creative nonfiction.
Wow. One of the things I've always wondered, I think why I like your memoirs so much is that they really kind of capture the essential pieces of the story. So how does a writer decide what to include in a memoir and then, you know, what to leave out?
Yeah, and that is something that I think a lot of beginning memoirists struggle with, because initially the impulse is that, oh, this is my memoir, so I have to write about my life. And in a way, that's not exactly true, because a memoir is really a slice of a life. It's really not your whole life. I mean, one's whole life, I mean, most of us don't have that exciting of a life. I mean, kind of if you're a celebrity, you know, then you kind of write your autobiography, you know, like Bill Clinton wrote My Life, and that's an autobiography, and that's a different kind of genre. But in memoir, it really is following one fairly narrow theme, so that you are following like one thematic slice of your life. But there's really good news in that you actually get to write more than one book. I mean, because in the first book, yes, I did. I just focused on the incestuous family, and I really did not get into the sex addiction at all. And clearly, in real life, there's a strong connection between, you know, the sex addiction and growing up in an incestuous family. I mean, the reason why I struggled with sex addiction was because my father had molested me. But when I sort of tried to put kind of the sex addiction material in the first book, it just didn't work. It was just the sound, the voice was just very different. And then I realized that that really was a good thing, because then I would be able to, after I finished the first book, then I would have another memoir to write, which is the one that deals with, you know, the 28 days I spent in rehab recovering from sex addiction. So it's really looking at a slice of a life and then following. It doesn't have to necessarily be chronological, but just sort of following one theme of your life kind of in any given book. Just for another example, I just finished working on another book. It's not published yet at all. But it is about sort of my ambiguous feelings toward Judaism. I'm Jewish, and the title of it is The Pat Boone Fan Club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew. And so it's sort of about how growing up I really wanted to be Christian, and so sort of how I've come to struggle with that. So that's a completely different theme, which I don't address at all in either of the first two books. So as I say, I mean, this really is good news that you don't want to sort of cram your whole life into one book. Just kind of, you know, take a deep breath, slow down, and just think about how many different ways one's life can be observed and explored.
Wow. That's a really helpful way to think about this. So, you know, how do we know where to begin the story? I mean, I think, you know, most, like, mystery novels begin at the most exciting part.
Mm-hmm.
And then we think of literary fiction kind of starting, like, with the backstory, with a little slower evolution. But so how does a memoir start? Where's a good place to begin our story? Do we do it thematically? Do we do it chronologically?
Probably there's not one right or wrong way to do it. For me, though, I tend to start pretty much at a moment of high drama when there's something really big at stake. I mean, what just happened that causes this memoir to start now? I mean, that's what I really ask myself. So, for example, in Lovesick, it really is about 28 days that I spend in this rehab unit. And I begin the memoir kind of the afternoon before I am about to enter rehab, because that's where there's a lot at stake. I'm going off to a motel to sort of have one last fix with this man that I've been having an affair with. And at that point, I know that this is a really bad thing for me to do, but I'm also really scared of entering rehab. So I begin at this kind of point of emotional tension, conflict. Should I meet this guy? Shouldn't I meet him? Am I really going to show up for rehab tomorrow? Can I just sort of like run away from home and not show up? So I do think it's important to begin at a moment in time when something crucial is at stake, when something's about to happen. The first book more or less begins just as I'm entering, starting therapy to work on the incestuous stuff. And then, you know, kind of goes back and forth in time. But I just think that you can't just sort of start, well, I was born, you know, on, I don't know, April 25th or whatever today is. I mean, that would be kind of tedious.
Mm.
So don't feel like you have to sort of follow this chronological, like first this happened, then this happened. Think of, you know, what is this memoir about and why does it start now? What just happened that's causing the narrator, you know, you, to want to come to grips with something. Is that clear, more or less?
Yeah, I like that way to think about it. Well, how can we bring our stories to life? One of the comments on yesterday's blog post on memoirs was they just love it when a writer can take a really small, boring event like ironing or eating an orange and make it kind of delicious and exciting. So tell us something about how to remember details and to make our kind of regular everyday lives more interesting in memoir.
And there actually is a very easy way to do that. Well, it's not always so easy to do, I guess, but it really is focusing on the five senses. Mm. I mean, that's how you it is, you're right. It's absolutely key to bring the reader inside the experience. Like if I just said, oh yeah, well my father sexually molested me when I was growing up, you might think, oh well that's too bad, Sue. But you wouldn't really know what that was like. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to sort of set scenes, and the way to set a scene is to heavily rely on all five senses. What does this moment smell like, taste like, you know, feel like, sound like? And what are the details if you're setting a scene just in the room where you're sitting right now. Say, what's the most important detail in this room, in the room where you are right now? And how does that affect sort of what's going on? I mean, like for me, like right now, I'm sitting in my office and I have this big kitty condo and my cat's asleep on the top level of her kitty condo. And I'm worried she's going to wake up and start annoying me in the middle of the interview. And so if I were writing about that, I mean, that's what I would sort of focus on. And, you know, but I would use all five senses, and I just can't say enough about that because that is the key to bringing your story to life, making it come alive, being able to sort of embed the reader inside your experience is to just, with every scene, what does something smell like? What does it sort of taste like, whether it's sort of metaphorically taste or real? I mean, just focusing on those five senses.
That's great.
And, you know, the other thing actually I might mention is that once you do that, you'll remember things that you didn't think you did remember. I mean, I remember when I was working on my first memoir, and the beginning part is when I was rather young. And you know, it's hard to remember back then. But I started trying to sort of close my eyes and try and get back into, what did that house that we lived in? Well, my father had this big electric saw in the living room. So there was the scent of sawdust. And then sort of having one scent lead to another scent, and then one sort of vision lead to another, and one taste lead to another. So once, you know, you're sort of in that mode, in that sensory mode, there are things that I just would never have remembered if I wasn't just really pushing myself to remember what, you know, what the sensory experience was. So that will, you know, so when we say, oh, I can't remember something, that's true if you're just sort of sitting there kind of abstractly thinking. But once you start actually putting words down on the page, and once you start really pushing what those sensory details were like, that will help you remember.
Wow. Yeah, I find that true, too. It doesn't usually come before I write, but that's while
right.
I'm writing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know what I think until I write. I mean, I just have to be writing.
Yes, I'm with you on that. And I noticed that in your book, that it was kind of this, you know, you're not really paying attention to your life until you start writing it down, which I thought was so true.
Exactly.
One of the things you mentioned a little bit earlier was that, you know, you waited till your parents had died before you wrote this memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I think a lot of us who want to write memoirs, I've actually written a memoir that's not published, but part of it is, how do we find the courage to both write the story, and then how do we find the courage to share it with friends, family, and then maybe even a larger audience?
Yeah, that is totally the big question, and it is something that if anybody who's listening now is worrying about that, you are not alone. I mean, everybody struggles with that. And while there's not an easy answer, and while I feel a little embarrassed, you know, saying this, since I didn't follow my own advice because I did wait for my parents to die, I might also say just on my behalf that I really had just started therapy when they died, and I wasn't very far along in my kind of journey of recovery at that point, and didn't have a strong sense of myself and my own sense of power. Mm. But here's the thing. I mean, first of all, I think, one, it's difficult to take on sort of the parents, family, friends in the world while you're writing. So my first bit of advice would be just write first. Get the story down on paper. That's the first step. And while you're doing it, don't even think about the outside world. Really, I mean, just tell yourself, look, I don't have to show this to anybody if I don't want to. And that's true, you don't. I mean, just for now, just know that within yourself, you're just writing it. You don't have to do anything with it. But if you don't get your story down, then, you know, it's just kind of lost forever. And that's really sad. So just get it down. It's kind of like one step at a time. And then once it's down on paper, then it's sort of the next step. Well, how do I feel? Am I brave enough to put it out there? And ultimately, my hope is that yes. I mean, because if you look at all the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of memoirs that have been published, let me reassure you that every single one of those authors worried about that. I mean, we all do. But the thing is that you own your truth. You own your story. Your voice is yours. Your story is yours. And if you don't tell it, nobody else will. And so it really is kind of like honor your voice and honor your story and know that, look, say if my sister were a writer, and I'm sort of glad she's not, but if she were, and she wrote a story about growing up in our family, sure, it'd be totally different from my story. I mean, her experiences were different. But that doesn't matter. I mean, that does not take away from the validity of my memories of what happened. I mean, so it's really just trusting in your memories, trusting in your voice. And I feel that our job as writers is not necessarily to make people feel comfortable or good. I mean, that's not our job as a writer. Our jobs as writers, it's to get our stories down, tell our truth, and put our voices out there.
You know, I have a follow-up question to this, because I think one of the things I hear so much from people who are writing memoirs is questions about the legal aspect. What happens when we write about a relationship, maybe a friendship or a romantic relationship, and the other person is still alive? Do we hide their name? Do we hide their identity? How does that work when you write a memoir?
Yeah, I mean, there is a concern, say, invasion of privacy thing. And basically, while you're writing, I wouldn't worry about it at all, because the publisher's legal department will worry about that for you. And it's always going to be different. For example, with the first book, yes, my parents were dead, but my sister was alive, you know, other people in the book. But first of all, I did change a lot of the names of friends. And, you know, so what? It doesn't make any difference. I did, however, use my husband's correct name and my therapist's correct name. Mm-hmm. And that was with the University of Georgia Press, and they were fine with that. I never even talked to a legal person. They just went with it, and everything was fine. Now, with Lovesick, the second book that was published with Norton, I did talk to their attorney, and they asked me to change the name of my husband and change the name of my therapist, even though I'd used their real name in my first book. They asked me to change the name of a motel where I'd met somebody. I mean,
wow.
Sort of like seemingly kind of funny, crazy sorts of things. I mean, I had already changed the names of all the women who were in rehab with me, because that just is obviously the correct thing to do. So I changed their names, and it doesn't take away from the story. It really doesn't matter. And I changed a few of their identifying characteristics, which, again, it really doesn't matter. And I changed the names of the men with whom I acted out with sexually. And, again, that does not take away from the validity of the story. So I had already done that anyway. And, you know, as I say, then the attorney asked me to change the name of, you know, my husband and my therapist. So I just let the Norton attorney sort of worry about that. And I don't know. I mean, nobody. I mean, you know, my husband, he's now an ex-husband. He never threatened to sue. I mean, he wasn't all that excited about the book. In fact, he was rather angry about it. Mm-hmm. But he never threatened to sue or anything. So if he wants to be angry, you know, that's sort of his choice. And I don't feel like I said anything that awful about him. But, you know, I mean, I think that I just don't, I think there's so many reasons why we could look at as to why not to write. that I try to just stop my brain from thinking about them and just more focus on the reasons why I should write. And then kind of just let things go where they're going to go. But there really are not that many lawsuits when all is said and done. You might, yes, of course, you probably may upset some people. But again, I don't think that our job is to make people feel comfortable. And, I mean, that's not what a job of a writer is. The job of a writer, and that's really whether you're a poet or a fiction writer. I mean, fiction writers get a lot of people upset, too. So do poets. But if you want to be an artistic person and live an artistic life, that is taking risks. Being an artist in this culture is risky. We're always putting ourselves out there, regardless whether you're an actor or a painter or a writer. We're always putting ourselves out there. And is it easy? No. But if you have to be a writer, then you just take these risks.
That's great. That's a great reminder. So, you know, in terms of taking risks, it seems to me that writing a memoir would be kind of a transformative risk. And I know when I was writing my memoir, it was a deep emotional process as well as a writing process.
Mm-hmm.
So, say something about, you know, how does writing a memoir change you, and or does it change you, and how you see yourself, and you know, what are some of the transformative elements of entering this work?
I think that it, for me, I just felt sort of like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders, in that it's kind of like, well, first of all, writing a memoir, you're sort of organizing your life, you're giving it a shape, you're giving it a structure, you're turning your life into art. I mean, that's what you're doing. And by doing that, adds an element of clarity. I mean, by writing, I'm discovering the metaphors also of my life. And so it gives it a kind of clarity that I never saw. Even though, I mean, I was in therapy for a gazillion years, but even so, it's a different process. And so now, for example, I mean, when I think of, yes, my father sexually molested me, it feels, I look at the book on my bookshelf and think that's sort of where it happened. I mean, it's kind of like taking the experience out of you and putting it someplace else, and I just don't feel burdened by it anymore. And so there is that transformative aspect of it, in that and then I'm really not keeping secrets anymore either. I mean, now I can just, it's all out there, so I don't have to worry, oh, is somebody going to find out my father sexually molested me? Well, anybody I meet is going to know that he did me.
And so
it just sort of like, it helps you sort of cut to the chase. Yeah, this is who I am, and yeah, that's it. But I'm also just, that's what happened to me. And it just doesn't affect me at all on a daily basis. Yes, of course, it shaped to a large extent who I am, obviously. But I don't feel the effects of it in that way anymore. It's just, it's now inside the pages of a book.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's just because you're figuring things out, and once the mystery of figuring something out is gone, then the mystery is kind of over. It's sort of like, say, you wouldn't necessarily reread a murder mystery because you already know sort of what happened. I mean, this is probably a really terrible analogy, but I sort of leapt into it, so I guess I'm stuck with it for now. But it's the kind of thing where, you know, you do, by writing a memoir, you do figure out kind of the mystery of your life. You understand, like, how things affected you, why, sort of what's the cause and effect, what is the metaphor for that experience. And once it's all figured out, it's just, well, that's done. Now I can move on to something else and write something else.
Wow. So it sounds like, I mean, one of the things I've been thinking about is this whole idea of journey and memoir. And I've noticed that there have been quite a few memoirs in the last few years on kind of actual journeys, like Wild, Cheryl Strayed's new memoir, and you know, A Walk in the Woods, which is kind of essay-esque memoir. But you're talking about an internal journey.
Exactly. I mean, memoirs can have both. and probably the best memoirs are ones that have both, that there is a kind of external journey. And but for me, the more interesting journey is probably the internal journey. For example, like on page one of any given memoir, me as narrator, I'm sort of one kind of persona. But then by the end of the memoir, things have happened to me. I've learned, I've grown, I've changed. And so now at the end, I see myself and my world so much differently. And these don't have to be big, you know, huge, you know, light bulb shattering kinds of things. I mean, they can be small insights or smallish epiphanies, but yet I feel like there has to be some kind of growth or change so that you do, it is the idea of journey, that you start one place. During the interval of the journey, things happen to you, good things, bad things, confusing things, conflicting things. But everything that does happen changes you, and you grow and you learn. So, of course, by the end, you're going to see yourself differently. And then the reader will, of course, also see you differently. So so basically what you're doing is taking the reader with you on this journey.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So how was it to write your adult story in Lovesick? Was it harder, easier, or different from writing the book about your childhood molestation and Because I Remember Terror?
It was a lot harder, as a matter of fact. I mean, just time-wise, the first book, as I said, took 3 months to write, which, though, let me hasten to add, is misleading, because I had been writing for 10 years before I wrote my first memoir, so don't think that I just started as a writer. But Lovesick took about 5 years to write. And the reason why is because it was hard for me to kind of hear the voice of this woman trying to get sort of sexually sober. I mean, I heard my addict voice because that addict voice had been with me for years and years and years. But the book wasn't about being a sex addict so much as it was about recovering from a sex addiction. Mm. So I really had to kind of discover this voice that was struggling to get sober. And it just took me a long time to hear it. I mean, that's just draft after draft after draft. And ultimately, Lovesick is a kind of twining together of the two voices. I mean, there is the voice of the addict in there, and there are flashbacks in the book that show my sort of acting out behaviors when I was not doing well. But then coupled with that sort of addict voice is the voice of the kind of more author, narrator, me in the present, really struggling to get better. So the whole book is kind of a twining together of these two voices. And it just took a long time to hear that voice. And then the other piece of it is that writing about my childhood as an incest survivor when my father is doing this like bad thing to me as a little kid, you sort of have built-in sympathy for yourself as the narrator. But in Lovesick, I'm an adult, married, having affairs. So in real life, I wasn't particularly sympathetic in many ways, unless, you know, you sort of know the whole history and everything. But I did have to discover that sort of voice that's struggling to be sober in order to kind of achieve some sort of sympathy and understanding for my motivations. I mean, so, yeah, it was harder in that sense to kind of find... I needed to find that voice to tell the whole story, but I also needed that voice, that sort of voice struggling to get sober, in order for the reader to feel some degree of sympathy towards me as a narrator. So they wouldn't just say, oh, how could, you know, she's an adult woman, she's married, how could she be having affairs?
Yeah.
And maybe some people, you know, didn't like me after reading it, and, you know, I can't control that, obviously. But I think on the whole, I feel... okay about the book in terms of that I was able to ultimately, after 5 long years of struggling with it, find that kind of sober voice, that kind of scared voice, like, oh, I know what I'm doing is bad for me, but I know I have to stop, and how am I going to stop, and how am I going to get better?
Yeah. Well, and it seems to me that, To me, that's really a challenging kind of tightrope to walk. The both presenting kind of the truth that's not really easy to see, the difficult or less good side of ourselves.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, presenting it in a way that's sympathetic so that readers can identify with us.
Exactly, exactly. You just absolutely hit it on the head. I mean, that is the key, because we can't, I mean, I don't write from a sense of revenge, like I'm going to blame everybody else for what happened to me. I mean, even in the first book, I tell it my truth, but I did not write the first book as an act of revenge against my father. I just didn't. I wrote it because I wanted to understand what happened to me growing up in this incestuous family. And likewise, in Lovesick, I mean, I could blame a lot of the really dangerous men with whom I acted out and had affairs. I mean, they weren't really good people or safe people. But again, I mean, I was as hard on myself as I was on anybody else that I write about, because you have to look at yourself, and with an enormous amount of emotional truth and emotional authenticity. I mean, you have to be willing to go there, to go to that dark place and really look at yourself and convey that on the page. And no, that's not easy. But ultimately, why else would we write a memoir other than to really understand who we were in this certain situation?
Well, and, you know, that's, you've talked a lot today about this idea of writing the truth, and I'm wondering if you can give us any advice as we struggle to write the truth, because I think that any of us who've been through a difficult situation, and especially for women, I'm sure men have this too, but there's this really, I don't know, the strong need to please others with what we write and the strong need to help others. And it seems to me memoir is kind of not in that pleasing or self-help or how-to genre. It's a little bit different. And so I think it's hard sometimes to access that truth and then tell that truth. It's so scary. So what
is
advice?
Scary.
Yeah, what advice do you have for us?
Do it anyway. I mean, sort of in a nutshell. I mean, because you're right. I mean, women, I mean, we're sort of a lot, particularly in my generation, I'm sort of like the hippie generation. I was sort of raised in that, first of all, I mean, this was all like pre-Oprah, so you don't like tell anybody family secrets. And you don't upset anybody. And, you know, I was raised like you have to be like a good little girl. And yes, memoir absolutely flies in the face of that. But I think what does help, here's my advice, is to join a community of other writers. Because, I mean, it's sort of funny to say, but I mean, I kind of base that on the whole 12-step model. Like, how do you recover from alcoholism or sex addiction?
Yeah.
I mean, you join a group. And even though writing is a good thing, we don't want to recover from it. In fact, we want to keep doing it. Still, there really is power in the group. And by being with either other women writers or just other writers, period, either way, who are struggling with the same things, I mean, that is how I think that does help us find strength. And then, too, I mean, just reading a bunch of other memoirs, I mean, I have had a lot of particularly women writers who have read my memoirs and think, okay, you know, like Sue did it and she survived, so I can do it. I mean, there absolutely is that idea of kind of joining forces.
Mm.
And if you are just all alone, really isolated in your room, and you're not reading other things and you're not in contact with other writers, it can feel overwhelming. But once you sort of start joining the tribe, as it were, then I think that makes it easier. I mean, one, you know, you mentioned that I teach at Vermont College of Fine Arts, which is a low residency MFA in writing program. And I mean, just being, I mean, that's one reason why I love to teach, because I do have students who, you know, are struggling with this. And just, I kind of like loan them my kind of energy and power until they kind of find their own. And, I mean, in addition to all of the craft stuff, of course. But just being with that community of writers, I mean, it is a low residency program, but twice a year we all meet on campus for like 10 days. And just having that energy of those other writers helps me a lot. It helps us all. And then during the rest of the semester, I have 5 students, and just even that small kind of community of these 5 other writers and me. But it just, it is hard to do it alone. And so just meet up, you know, well, what you're doing. I mean, you, like through your website and your blog site and everything, I mean, you offer a community for writers to kind of hang out, you know, with each other. And all of that helps.
So do you have any suggestions for how we can find a safe community in our kind of where we live? I think, I mean, one of the things that I notice about writing communities is that they can be just as challenging and shaming as any other community. So what are some things that we might look for as we kind of vet a community?
Well, really trust your gut. I mean, that's everything. I mean, if you walk in, I mean, because I've been in 12-step groups, and I thought, like, you know, I've been in 12-step groups where, you know, it's with people who are all struggling with sex addiction. But I walk in and something just doesn't feel right, I get up and walk out. I mean, just know that you can do that. I mean, that you have that power, because you can tell, you know, if you really listen to yourself, as in any situation, if you're in a bad relationship, whatever it is, it's the same thing. If something doesn't feel right, then it isn't right. So get out and find, you know, a place that is. I mean, you know, one thing that is helpful, I mean, there are loads of, like, summer writers' conferences. So go to some, because that's where you'll meet people. And even though the conference might only last a week, still, you meet people who then, you know, you exchange email addresses with, and then you're friends for life, and you can share your work with somebody else. So that's another way to meet people. I mean, like where I live in this tiny little town, Grand Haven, Michigan. I mean, there's not, you know, a writer's group here. I'm sure I could probably find one, you know, in some larger city close by. But if you live in a place where it's going to be harder to find one. I mean, one thing is, if you really want to, like if there's a local college or university, see if they have a writing program or, you know, something for adult education. But if you just don't have resources in your community, just one summer, choose one writer's conference that's maybe not too far away. Go to it. You'll meet writers there. Then you'll be able to have somebody to exchange work with. So, and then, of course, all the resources on the internet. I mean, it's just vast. So, I mean, there's a website, www.shewrites.com, which is just for women writers. It's a great resource and a great way to meet other women writers.
Oh, that's great. So, you know, I was enchanted by your list of memoirs on your website. I've been collecting memoirs for years, and I sell them thematically, so all my illness memoirs are together and all my adventure memoirs are together. So I was like, oh, I was so tickled. So talk a little bit about theme and memoir and some good examples from a few of the things that are your favorites so our listeners can get an idea of what to look for.
Yeah, right. On my website, for those of you who haven't, it's like just go to SueWilliamSilverman.com. And then if you scroll down on the right-hand side, you'll see a link that says Sue's reading list. So just click on that and you'll see it. And yes, as Rochelle mentions, I have divided into category. I mean, the first one is like illness, accident, grief, and addiction. The second one is family, relationships, identity. The next one is childhood and coming of age. And, you know, then there's one for like nature writing. So yeah, I kind of broke it down like that. Just kind of help people navigate their way through, you know, just all the hundreds and hundreds of memoirs that are out there being written. Now, mind you, I've not read or even close to all of the memoirs on this list, because, you know, a lot of them are through recommendations. So if any of you listening have any recommendations, please email me and let me know. But, you know, but they're just, you know, but sort of if you're working in one area, I mean, say you are working on childhood memoir, sort of coming of age, then you can look in that category and see maybe some how some other people have handled things like that. You know, one really good memoir, say, in that category is Patricia Hempel's A Romantic Education, sort of how she kind of came of age and in this kind of Catholic Polish upbringing. And so, you know, just, and of course with Amazon, it makes it really easy because you can, before you kind of buy anything, you can kind of go visit, you know, get a description of it. Or in that category, a really wonderful, beautiful book is Persian Girls by Nahid Rachlin, R-A-C-H-L-I-N, and how she grew up in Iran when the Shah was in power and all the restrictions against women. And so, yeah, I really, you know, invite you to visit, you know, this reading list and start reading, because the best way to improve your writing is just, yeah, I mean, there are craft books, and of course I wrote one myself, but in addition to reading craft books, just equally important is to just read as many memoirs as possible. And those maybe that aren't necessarily related to your subject matter. Yeah. You know, I mean, just read as kind of widely as possible. I mean, like, I enjoy reading a lot of nature books. I'm not a nature writer. I don't even particularly like taking walks. I mean, the thought of taking a walk in the woods is horrifying to me. So, you know, I mean, I don't go camping. I just wouldn't even consider going camping. So it's nothing that I write about or care about in the real world, but I love reading nature books, and that's sort of how I get. I feel like I'm, you know, out on a nature walk, and I don't actually have to put on any shoes to do it. So
that's why I liked Wild, because I could kind of just, you know,
yeah.
Wow, how cool that she peed in the woods. Not that I would ever do that. But
right. Well, exactly. So it takes. So yeah. So sort of be open to these other adventures that people have, for sure.
And I think, I mean, one of the things I tell people who are writing books, and one of the things I do a lot is that when I come to a craft question, like, how do I structure this book? Or, you know, should I be past tense or present tense? How do I deal with backstory? Looking at other people's memoirs kind of with that structural eye or that craft eye can be a very helpful way to learn.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just by reading as much as you can, it will, your writing will grow enormously from that.
Yeah. Well, I want to open it up to questions, so I'm going to unmute the line and let people who are here ask questions. So you're all unmuted. Does anybody have a question for Sue? We have a pretty quiet group, usually. Nobody, usually, where everybody's at their desks eating lunch doing this. So,
well, first of all, whoever is listening in, I'd like to thank you for listening. And I really am open to any questions, anything you, that, I mean, there's no such thing sort of as a not a good question. I mean, just anything that you're thinking about, or even if you have a comment, or just anything. I mean, I really would welcome talking about just about anything. So if you do, please feel free to.
I have a question.
Good.
Yeah. Hey, this is Sally from North Carolina. Did you share this, say, your first book with your sister before it was published?
That is a very good question. And the answer is no, I did not. In fact, I didn't even tell her. She knew I was a writer, but she also sort of knew that I started as a fiction writer. I did not even tell her about it until the book was almost on the shelf. I mean, I just, we have sort of a difficult relationship, and I just didn't want her kind of being negative about something that I was really excited about. And I certainly don't think that any writer needs to, like, clear something, like, sort of get somebody's blessing before something is published, because,
right.
I mean, I just don't believe in that at all. I mean, I just truly think that we have to trust our own memories, trust our stories, trust our voices, and just believe in our own truths. And while, you know, I don't necessarily recommend that you wait until the book is actually on the shelves before you tell anybody, but I don't think, but what I would encourage you not to do, I mean, just don't feel like you have to get somebody's blessing before it's published. So, no, I mean, I really, the only people who see my work pre-publication are sort of people who are like editors who are helping me with the book, you know, obviously the editor at the publishing company, but also I, my partner now, he happens to be a really terrific editor. So I show my work to him, not to kind of, well, I don't even really write about him, so it's not to get his blessing or anything, but really just for help, you know, like say for, with a writing group. So those are the only people who would, who see my work sort of pre-publication.
Did you write about her in the book?
Yes, yes, she is in the book. Yeah, she's she's in particularly in the first, she's a little bit in the second book, but particularly in the first book. And when I did tell her about it, I mean, she, for her, she, I mean, she tried to be happy for me. I mean, she hasn't read, she has not read either of my books, I should hasten to add, nor will she. And that's okay. I mean, I don't care if she, you know, if she doesn't feel comfortable reading them, that's fine. You know, I mean, I think that she is sort of wished that I had gone on to publish fiction and not write about her family. But and from her perspective, sure, why wouldn't she? But at the same time, like, she has friends who have been sexually molested, and she tells her friends about the book. You know, so all in all, she actually took it better than I thought she would. So, I mean, people can surprise you, you know. I mean, in fact, nobody in my extended family gave me any grief at all about the first book. And there's lots of reasons why they could have, but they really didn't. So the only person who ever got angry at me, which I mentioned earlier, is my now ex-husband. You know, after Lovesick was published, he was not happy.
Right.
But other than that, I've actually, from friends and family, I've had really good reaction from people.
Wow.
So you never know. People can surprise you.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the good question.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
Yes, I have a couple of questions.
Uh-huh.
They're sort of unrelated, but
okay.
One, I'll ask the first one. The first one's easier, I think. Sue, could you comment at all about your work habits? Do you write always in the morning? Do you write longhand? Do you write on the computer? Do you write for a certain number of minutes or hours per day, et cetera, that sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. I basically try to write as soon as I get up in the morning, because once I start sort of getting into the email world and everything, then it's really downhill. and so as soon as I get up in the morning, before the world becomes too clear and I can really kind of focus on the more internal journey of words, that's really when I try to write. And I do try to write a few hours every day, but you know, the days when I mentioned that I teach and that it's kind of a long distance thing, when my student work comes in those days I don't write, and I really focus on my students' work. So I don't so I'm not able to write every day, but when I do, and I write, yes, I write at, what I do is I write everything out on my computer. And then I print it out, and then I take a pencil, and in longhand, I do a lot of editing on the page. And then I take all those edits, and I type them into the computer, and then I print it out again and do the same thing over and over and over again. And for some reason, that seems to work for me. I need to both see it on the, type it on the screen, because it just goes so much faster. But then I also have to like tangibly hold pencil in my hands and paper in my hands in order to do editing. So yeah. So then you had another question.
Yes. This is Ed from Wisconsin.
Oh wait, I'm sorry. Wait. I'm sorry. I think this other person had one other question, and then we'll get to you. Okay.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. It's hard to hear. So, yeah, you had a second question?
Yes, this is Peggy from Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
I know you're not a lawyer, but I have an issue with what I'm writing that is Well, basically, a character in the book or the book itself is actually accusing someone of abuse, of sexually abusing a child. What do you think, and I'm trying to locate a good intellectual property lawyer, but what do you think the legal ramifications or position would be with that?
That is really tough, and that probably really is beyond my realm of anything that I would, yes, see a lawyer. I don't know how much you can, like, try and change the person's identity. I mean, if you're going in that direction, then I would think if you can really, like, change where they live, their name, and a lot of characteristics, then, frankly, I wouldn't worry about it too much. But if you have to use, for whatever reason, their real name and where they live, then, yeah, just talk to an attorney, because I really don't know about that. But I think that's really important to write about. And so, you know, I hope that you're able to kind of sort through a way of being able to do that. So, yeah, good
Thank
luck.
You.
You're welcome. And then there's a gentleman who had a question.
Yes, this is Ed from Wisconsin.
Hi, Ed.
So many of the things you said are ringing true. I belong to a writer's group here. I have for a year and a half.
Good.
And I have a memoir that's about ready to be shown to an editor and then a publisher. And I can certainly find an editor through my writer's group, and we've been discussing publishing, but I wondered if you could share something about first steps in that next big step of getting something published for the first time.
Sure. I mean, the first thing is kind of a choice as to whether you want to try, like, to get an agent and go with a big New York publisher, or if you want to not get an agent and go with, like, a university press or a small independent press. So that's kind of the first choice that you make. And kind of briefly, kind of the pros and cons, I mean, if you go with New York, you'll get more money, maybe more recognition and more sales. But at the same time, like, if the book doesn't really hit big or relatively big, then the book will be out of print relatively quickly, maybe even within a year, maybe even 6 months. So those are sort of like the big kind of pros and cons of New York. In terms of a smaller press, an independent press, a university press, you won't get as much money and they won't print as many copies of your book, but there's a good chance your book will be in print forever. And I've published with both. I've published with university presses, and then Lovesick was published with W.W. Norton, which is a big New York publisher. And I basically have had good experiences with both. So it really comes down to your comfort level. Like, what do you want more? Do you want to try and hit it big with New York and earn a lot of money? Or does that not interest you as much, but you really want your book to be in print much, much longer? And that's something that only you can decide. And if you want to pursue an agent, then, oh, gosh, there are just tons of websites online that just have lists of agents. I mean, just start Googling it, and you'll find some. If you have trouble, my email address, well, it's on my website, but it's suesilverman@charter.net. And I can just email me, and I can give you some links to websites to look for agents. Now, if you're interested in pursuing, like, the smaller publishers and university presses, there's a really terrific website. It's www.newpages.com. And that just has wonderful lists of tons of smaller independent publishers and the kinds of things they're looking for. So that's how I would sort of start out and then kind of take it from there. Does that sort of answer your question?
It sure does. And just one more comment.
Sure.
Going through the writing process, I, too, do a brain dump on the computer and reread the pages with a pencil. But I've also gotten out a pair of scissors and chopped things up and pasted them back together again So I wanted to throw in the comment about the scissors, and thank you very much for offering this great opportunity today.
Oh, thank you. And yes, that scissors and chopping things up is also very helpful. And I also as another thing that I've done is, like, once I've printed things out and I'm not sure about what order they need to be in, like, I'll just put pages all over the floor and sort of shuffle them around, or chapters on the floor, and sort of see, kind of visualize things in that way. So, yeah, that. Thank you for mentioning the old scissors part of it.
No, you're welcome.
And Ed, just a note on the agents thing. We had Michael Larson here a few, 2 months ago, I think. So his class is up on the Right Now Mastermind page, or Always Right page. And in our email after this, I'll include the link to his blog post, because he had a list of steps to go through to find
an agent. Oh, terrific. Okay, that's great.
I just came in at this juncture. So my writing instructor told me about this because I'm writing a memoir.
Oh, good. If you're signed up for this group, then you'll get the memoir recording, and then I'll remind everybody where the other links are.
Terrific.
We have time for a final tip from you, Sue. What's your final words of wisdom before we go?
I think my final words of wisdom, well, and this really is not to plug my craft book, Fearless Confessions, but I think really the reason why I entitled it that is because we really do have to write fearlessly.
Mm.
I mean, I think that, all of this is scary. Writing is scary, regardless of what you're writing about, it's scary. Trying to get published is scary. Actually getting published is scary. It really, just as I mentioned before, everything in the arts, putting yourself out there artistically, is a big leap of faith. And I just want to encourage everybody that even if you feel scared, to do it anyway. You really can. And it's so important, because if your voice is lost, there's nobody else who can tell your story. I mean, we own our stories. We're the only ones who can tell them. And so I just want to, if I can at all, encourage you to find some amount of courage in, maybe this conversation we've all had today and that we're all together. Just find some place where you can find some courage so that you know that you're not alone, and that writing is just crucial. Your voice is important. Your story is important. And so even if you are scared, just to do it anyway. And you might be surprised about all the good things that actually will happen after all is said and done. I mean, that's certainly been my experience. I mean, just the emails and connections I've made with just amazing, amazing people who read my books. It empowers me. I mean, it's incredible just to have those connections. So as Rochelle might say, right now.
Oh, that's great. I really appreciate this, Sue, and I think all of us who sit here kind of with our knees knocking as we're sitting at the computer.
Oh, it's
appreciate
scary.
We appreciate your encouragement to take a leap of faith. And I think, it's very different from the visual arts, where we can hear people walk by and say, oh, that's great. It takes a lot of courage to get everything all together before we send it out.
I know. It does.
Group, I want to remind you that I'll be sending you a link to Sue's books and her website when I send you the link about the recording. If you want to visit Sue online, you can find her website on the Right Now Mastermind page, or you can find the link in my email. But it's SueWilliamSilverman.com. And in this age of Google, you can just Google her and find her quite easily. Next month, again, we'll be having my husband, Harold Epley, who's just published his novel, talk about his more than 100 rejection slips that he accumulated on the way to publication. And in June, we'll be having a mystery writer. And it's still a mystery to me, but I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say. So thanks, everyone, and remember to always write. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.